morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loright. Coming up today, we're going to hear Florida This Week, which is a discussion show about state and local politics. We'll hear that first, and then we'll open up the phone lines and talk about some of the issues we discussed on the TV show. And while we're listening back to the TV show, you can email the studio with your comments about the topics we're discussing, the address dj@wmnf.org. Well, here's Florida This Week, which originally airs Friday nights on WEDU-TV, locally the PBS station. It's a program that I host, and here is this week's program. Coming up next, the Florida House passes a bill to add more penalties against people who participate in protests that turn violent. Florida's lowering the age to get the COVID vaccine. Large rowdy crowds gather for spring break in Miami. What's it like to be a COVID long hauler? And a new investigation finds a Tampa factory that may be poisoning its workers. All coming up next on Florida This Week. Welcome back. Governor Ron DeSantis is dropping the eligibility age for the COVID vaccine from 50 to 40 on Monday, and the week after, the vaccine age will drop to 18. The governor says more than 70% of the roughly 4.4 million seniors living in Florida have already been vaccinated. The governor has been a big proponent of opening the state, boasting that he reopened the state more quickly than most other states. Apparently, spring breakers are listening, with huge crowds showing up in Florida, especially in Miami Beach, where the crowds were so large this week that a SWAT team was called out to control them. This week, those large spring break crowds in Miami Beach prompted police to take extraordinary measures to crack down on the revelers. Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber imposed an 8 p.m. curfew to try to control the largely maskless crowd. Mayor Gelber is a former state legislator and has been the mayor of Miami since 2017, and he joins us now. Dan Gelber, welcome to Florida This Week.
Glad to be here.
The governor has continuously said over the last few months that Florida is open for business. Do you tie the large crowds there in Miami Beach this week to the governor saying we're open for business?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly there's a lot of people here because there's that and there's no other destinations out there. So I think the typical amount of people we get, which is a lot in spring break, has been really redoubled or even higher because we're the only game in town. Of course, the governor is saying we're in an oasis of freedom here. So I think we're getting a lot of people.
So you've imposed a temporary curfew in South Beach several days a week. What's been the situation since you imposed a curfew?
Well, I think we've hopefully cornered it off a little bit. We think that people are going to be a little bit more compliant with our laws. Of course, they're not going to really have a choice because after 8 p.m., nobody's allowed really out in the entertainment district. And this is a pretty small area of our city. It's really only about 4 blocks by 10 blocks. The city's about 7.5 miles wide. So it's really a very discreet area. And of course, at 10 p.m. During the weekends, we're also not letting, we're sort of closing our causeways other than to local and hotel traffic and workers and residents. So we're trying to just limit the number of people. We're sort of a big venue as a city. We're an island. And when we hit capacity, it just creates management problems, security problems, gridlock, and things like that. So it's something we've got to be aware of.
This week, SWAT teams were called out earlier this week to try to quell the crowds. And some people in the black community have said the city of Miami Beach would not have treated the GLBTQ community the same way as it's treated this majority black group that's come out. What do you say to the critics?
You know, we've been responding to conduct, not to race. If you look at the videos, it's very hard to, you know, really question whether or not it merited some kind of response. We've had people bring guns. The people who are bringing guns are driving cars without standing warrants. So we know they shouldn't even have guns. We've had a lot of open brawling. We've had worse than that, by the way. So these are security issues that you cannot leave unattended. It's the first order of government is to secure everybody. So it's not a race issue. It's a conduct issue. And we would respond to any group that's throwing rocks, that's brawling, that's discharging weapons in large crowds. That's That's just not behavior that's going to go unresponded to.
The governor has told businesses that have been fined previously for not policing the mask ordinance and social distance regulations or recommendations. He said to those businesses, you don't have to pay the fines. What does that do to your job as a mayor to try to help keep people safe?
You know, the frustration is that my city was the first city in the country to impose a mask mandate after the CDC said to do so. And we had issued 1,000 citations. But the purpose isn't to get money. It's not a fundraiser for our city. It's to sort of inspire a culture of compliance. It's the reason there are seatbelt laws. We don't arrest a lot of people for violating seatbelt laws. But the moment we made it a law and everybody said to do it, everybody started doing it. Problem that the governor with what the governor's done is it's not just that we can't enforce it, but it's just that we've lost the voice of the most prominent voice in the state in urging people to comply. When a hurricane is coming to us, from the governor to the lowliest mayor, we are all on the same page. And people, I think, respond to that because they say, well, if they're all agreeing about this, then there must be something to it. Now people can select what they want. And a lot of them are agreeing with the governor, just saying, well, if he says I don't need a mask, then I don't want one. So the problem is one of compliance, because really government has not had a unified voice. Fortunately, I think the governor follows an ideology about this and not a science.
As you know, there's a lot of mask skeptics out there, and there's people that are saying, well, if you're outdoors, it's not as crucial to wear a mask or socially distance because they say that the virus isn't that transmissible outdoors and that, you know, if people want to congregate outdoors, let them. What do you say?
Look, you know, there are a lot of opinions. You can find any opinion you want on the internet or with political leaders. The overwhelming number of scientists say you should wear masks. For my city, we tend to have typically very large gatherings, unfortunately, like the ones you've seen on videos of the city most recently. That's not a good thing to have in a pandemic. My residents have been quite good, by the way. But the problem is you have so many people coming from all over the state and the nation, if not the world. And what we don't want to do is become a super spreader. And we have a lot of variant, a lot of the British variant in Dade County and in Florida. So we're just trying to be good stewards of everybody's health. And I wish the governor would help a little bit more because we're near the end of this. And his voice is an important one. And I wish it was pushing people to at least follow what is recommended by the vast majority of scientists.
Dan, over the years, your name comes up over and over again as a possible contender for a statewide office. Do you have any thoughts about running for either the U.S. Senate next year or the governor's race next year?
I always love when these questions are asked of me or anyone else, and there's a level of coyness that nobody thinks is real. Like, the truth of the matter is you've got to have an abiding hunger to put aside everything else in your life to run for statewide office. Florida's too big and broad a state, and the issues are too important. And I don't know that I have that hunger right now. Will I get that? I don't know. But right now I'm happy in the city that the only hometown I've ever known where I get to, you know, do my kids' homework with him. Not too much of it, though. I want his teachers to know, to be part of his life and my wife's life and my family's life. So I like being here. If that changes, you'll be in the top 50 to know.
Dan Gilbert, Mayor, thank you very much for coming on Florida this week.
Sure.
Governor Ron DeSantis is lowering the age for COVID-19 vaccinations to those 40 and older beginning on Monday. The week after that, anyone 18 and over will be eligible. Our next guest did not get the benefits of the vaccine. He's a COVID long hauler. Our guest is Rush Roberts. He's a Tampa Bay area firefighter and a paramedic and an Ironman athlete who contracted COVID-19 a year ago. And since then, he's suffered with the symptoms for 11 of the last 12 months. He's just 37 years old. Rush joins us now on the road. He's taking his family on vacation. Rush Roberts, welcome to Florida This Week.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
How are you feeling now?
I am happy to say that I am at 100% and been feeling good. I have been off medication for about 3 weeks, and get life back to normalcy. That's why the family and I are hitting the road to enjoy the weekend.
So you're the last person I think many people would think of as a COVID long hauler. You suffered the symptoms for 11 of the last 12 months. How bad was it? And only what you feel comfortable telling us, but how bad were your symptoms?
It definitely came in stages originally, and I was one of the earlier ones to get it. I had bilateral pneumonia, which ended up giving me asthma and bronchitis, which wasn't horrible but wasn't easy to deal with at the time. After 3 months, I had battled and beat through all that and had gone back to work for about 2 months, and then developed a lung infection with some pleurisy. And directly after that, I contracted several blood clots in both my upper and lower lungs, which took about 6 months to recover from.
A lot of younger people feel they're impervious to the disease. And you know, we're seeing a lot of people show up in Miami Beach this week. We're seeing people out at bars. Some bars are crowded. They're indoors. What do you say to young people, based on your experience? What do you say to young people who feel impervious to COVID-19?
Yeah, you know, I was as healthy as they came. I was training for a half Ironman. I was biking up to about 200 miles a week and running at least 26 to 30 miles a week, swimming on top of that. And I went from all that to laying in bed, propped up with pillows, trying to breathe. That's not true. People can be impervious to it. People might not even notice how sick they are or that they're even that sick, but you don't want to be part of the 2% like I was. I never would have imagined it would have affected me the way it did.
What does your doctor say about long-term? I mean, you're a COVID long hauler. What does your doctor say about long-term? Could the symptoms come back that you experienced over the last 11 months?
That's the hard part with it all. On top of all the doctors that I had, it always ends up the same way. At some point, they say, we just don't know. We there's just not enough data out there. When I was released back to work, it's been great, but they're always ready for me to come back if I need it or if anything changes. They're fully prepared to see me again if it happens, but we're hoping we don't have to go that route.
So what would you say to folks that think masks are unnecessary and think that they can go back right now to life as it was before everybody's vaccinated?
I think everyone needs to just listen to the CDC guidelines with the masks. But, most of all, just be responsible. You got to live your lives. I understand wanting to go to the beach with your family and friends or any of that stuff, but you still have to do it responsibly. You don't need to go with 20 people. Still keep your distance. Just live your life, but be responsible. Follow the rules, and hopefully we can get out of this soon.
So when are you doing the next Ironman event?
I am scheduled for April 18th for the half Ironman in Haines City. It has been a very tough road from being able to start to exercise as little as 4 or 5 months ago to actually getting the mileage down. So if I actually make it, it'll be by the skin of my teeth, but it'll probably be the most proud I've ever been.
Well, Rush Roberts, thanks a lot. Have a safe trip to Fort Myers, and good luck in the Ironman.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
The Florida House on Friday passed HB1, the so-called anti-rioting legislation that is one of the top priorities of Governor Ron DeSantis. Tara Newsom is an attorney and a professor at St. Petersburg College. She teaches her students about the law and has given a TEDx talk entitled "The Constitution, It's Personal." Tara, welcome back to Florida this week.
Great to see you, Rod. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you, too. First of all, let's talk about HB1. The governor and others say we have to pass this bill in Florida because we don't want Florida to become another Seattle or Portland. What do you think about adding more penalties on top of the penalties we already have against violent protests?
You know, I think HB 1, which is the anti-riot bill, has some intended consequences, some unintended consequences. But as an academician, I think it's important for viewers to understand that the United States has a storied history in protecting freedom of speech, all the way back from the Sedition Act, which said anytime you critically say anything about the United States government, you could be penalized, and that was struck down as unconstitutional, to making sure that if you say anything, clear and present danger might not protected by the First Amendment, or anytime you say something that would incite violence isn't protected by the First Amendment. But the truth is that the courts have given us a fine line on whether, you know, the freedom of speech and the freedom of assemble and petition are protected. And often when it comes to freedom of speech, we have that fine line. But when it comes to assembly and protest, it gets a little bit murkier. And so I think that the legislature would be wise to pay attention to what we call the chilling doctrine. And that's anytime the government has a piece of legislation that creates a chilling effect on our freedom of expression, that it really is suspect from a constitutional perspective.
I'm wondering whether or not this might backfire on those Republicans and conservatives who support the Capitol protesters, not those who breached the Capitol, but those who stood outside. The proposed Florida law says that if you're part of a protest and it turns violent, everybody who's involved in that protest gets charged with a felony. So if we look at the example of the Capitol protest, how do you think the Florida law might apply?
You know, I think we need to contextualize this in terms of how it could apply to everyone. So imagine I have a son who's at University of Florida. Go Gators. And imagine the Gators in the fall win a national football championship. Okay. And they spill out into the streets and they celebrate and unintended activities occur. Or you're at the Capitol and you're passionate and unintended activities occur. Will this legislation be applied to them? Or is the sole intent of this legislation to go after social justice and Black Lives Matter? And I think what we need to really stop and consider is, why is there a Black Lives Matter movement? The movement stemmed from either legislation or the application of laws in a disproportionate way to people of color. And what I worry about, and many people worry about, is does this law, is it going to fall into a category that isn't necessarily applied to everyone equally? Will it be applied to those protesting at the Capitol? Is it the ideology that will be dependent on whether it's being applied or not? Will it be the color of your skin? That's the kind of things Floridians need to contextualize when they're looking at this bill.
Well, speaking of context, the state legislature also appears ready to curtail some aspects of voting by mail. And when you put these two things together, HB 1, the anti-riot bill, and this effort to at least limit some parts of mail-in voting, how do you see it?
You know, I think the cachet of legislation that's coming out of Tallahassee right now needs to be looked at as a whole. And so HB 1, the anti-riot bill, standing alone, is worrisome, but it becomes incredibly worrisome when you combine it with the movement of Senate Bill 90, which is really this bill that seeks to create a greater integrity in the Florida election system. It is without a doubt that in 2020, we had the most safe, most effective election that we've ever had. And for 20 years, from 2000 to 2020, Republicans utilized mail-in ballots, which is what Senate Bill 90 is going after, mail-in ballots, dropping off mail, mail-in ballots, and then, of course, the drop boxes. We had a wonderful success. And it seems to, from its face, look like Republicans were very happy with mail-in ballots until the 2020 election, when a disproportionate amount of mail-in ballots favored Democratic candidates. And so you've got to look at HB 1 combined with Senate Bill 90 and sort of start to color in the lines. And Florida voters need to look at that and say, what is this really saying to us? What is the Florida legislature really saying? And not look at these bills necessarily in silos.
Tara, I wish we had more time, but it's always great to see you. Thanks for coming on Florida This Week.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob. Take care.
Take care. For years, hundreds of workers at the Gopher Resource Lead Smelting Plant in East Tampa were exposed to dangerous levels of lead in the air. Poisoned is a new investigative series from the Tampa Bay Times in collaboration with the PBS Frontline Local Journalism Initiative. Times investigative reporter Corey G. Johnson is part of the team that gained access to thousands of documents showing the health problems at the plant, and he joins us now. Corey, welcome to Florida This Week.
Thank you for having me.
Let's show the viewers some of the opening video in your series that is part of the Frontline series.
About 300 people work at Gopher Resource. Workers take old car batteries and recycle them. They remove the lead and melt it down in furnaces that burn at 1,500 degrees. It's dangerous work.
All I hear is boom! And next thing I know, I'm hopping on 1 foot out the building.
Corey, that looks like dangerous work. It looks like something out of 100 years ago in a sweatshop. What is that dust? Is that lead dust? And how dangerous is that dust for the people that work there?
Yes, that dust is lead. It's not dirt. It looks like dirt, but it's lead. There's also other toxins in there. On some days it's cadmium. Some days it's arsenic as well, but it's mostly mainly lead. And lead is a neurotoxin. When it gets into the body, there's no use for it in the body at any level. It can damage your kidneys. It can damage your cardiovascular systems. For kids, it can damage their brains. It's a very, very dangerous substance, and it's supposed to be highly regulated.
Did you find workers who had long-term illnesses as a result of working in that factory?
Yes, and the number is still growing. Within the last 5 years, we found at least 14 workers who've had either heart attacks or strokes that could very much be associated or potentially associated with their lead exposure. The numbers are staggering in terms of the hundreds of workers who had high lead in their blood. And one of the things that we found as well is for many, many years, the level of exposure exceeded what their respirators, the workers' respirators, could protect, sometimes hundreds of times higher than what the federal limit was for exposure. And as the story runs, we're hearing from more and more workers each day. And so some of the things that we're reporting may likely end up being an undercount of the harm.
When I see these clouds of lead dust, I wonder, where's OSHA? Where's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration? Have they come in and have they told the plant managers it's too dangerous?
Well, what our reporting found is that OSHA hadn't inspected the plant for lead since 2014. And what's intriguing about that, which is going to come out in the days ahead, is that the local office were under, the Tampa office was under orders basically from both the national OSHA and the regional office to do increased inspections of businesses who dealt with lead. And so during the time period of these orders, we're actually seeing that the plant got no inspections or no visits. And we're trying to wrap our arms around why that happened.
I've read in your series that many of the people that work at this plant are people of color. Are they afraid to speak out, or what have they said about why these conditions continue?
Many workers were afraid for various different reasons. Some feared retaliation. Some really liked the job, and they liked the camaraderie with their workers, and they feared that a lot of scrutiny could end up closing the plant, which could hamper their ability to feed themselves and their family. So there has been a lot of fear about airing out what some of these workers knew. Yes.
Is there a union at the plant?
For most of the time that plant has existed, they did not have a union. In late 2019, the workers actually voted for the first time to bring a union. My understanding is that the union is still trying to get on its feet. It may not even have a contract with the company yet. So the union there is in its infancy. But during the time period of most of the reporting that we're finding over this decade, there was no union in place to give these workers protections.
Corey Johnson, thanks a lot. It's a really important series, and thank you for doing it.
Thank you for having me.
You can view the Tampa Bay Times and Frontline series Poisoned on our Facebook page and at wedu.org/Florida This Week. Finally, the alt-country Texas band, the Vandaliers, are based in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And like all of us, during the pandemic, they miss playing in front of a real live audience. Here they are, looking forward to the good times again. Stay safe. We'll see you next week. The closing song on Florida This Week from the Vandaliers. You've been listening to Florida This Week on WMNF in Tampa. My guest on that program, Dan Gilbert, the Miami Beach mayor, Rush Roberts, a COVID long hauler and a 37-year-old athlete and firefighter here in the Tampa Bay area, Corey Johnson, an investigative reporter at the Tampa Bay Times, and Tara Newsom, a professor at St. Pete College. She happened to work as a congressional staffer on the Bill Clinton impeachment when she worked in Washington. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard so far, you can email us here in the studio, the address dj@wmnf.org. You can also call us on the studio line. Frank Knox is picking up the phones, and talk to Frank and then me at 813-239-9663. We talked about the HB1, the protest penalty bill that's moving its way through Tallahassee, almost assuredly headed for the governor's desk. We talked about the large crowds in Miami Beach and the mayor's concern about spreading COVID. We talked about the effects of COVID on an athlete who's experienced the effects of COVID-19 for 11 of the last 12 months. And we also talked about that investigation into worker safety at an East Tampa lead smelting plant, one of the few lead recycling plants in the country. And you couldn't see the video, but workers are depicted working in a cloud of lead dust. Looks very dangerous. And we're going to talk about that topic tomorrow here on WMNF when we get another one of the investigative reporters on from the Tampa Bay Times to tell us more about the series. Well, if you want to call us, here's the number, 813-239-9663. We got a few emails in. And John wrote in regarding COVID. John writes this, I wonder how many of the people who refused to wear masks went and got a vaccine. Also, I wonder how many people who said COVID was a hoax went and got a vaccine. That's from John, who's in Port Richey. Well, we know for certain that President Trump, who was a longtime COVID skeptic, at least in public, he did get the vaccine. But he didn't get the vaccine in public. He had COVID and then a few weeks later got the vaccine. So there's one skeptic. Karen in Dunedin says, I've got my first shot, but even after my second shot, I fear life will not get back to normal. I know too many people who aren't going to get the vaccine. I will feel the need to protect them, though, like that firefighter, they're extremely healthy. I'm afraid they will have to experience COVID firsthand, writes Karen in Dunedin. Talking about her anti-vaxxer friends. Okay. Well, we're going to open up the phone lines, take some calls, and discuss some of these new news items. And there's a whole lot else going on in the news, so we could talk about other things too. But if you want to talk about any of the topics so far, you can call us at 813-239-9663. You can also email the studio at this address. Send it to dj@wmnf.org. I'm going to mention a few other stories that we might talk about, and then we'll see. Usually the first few callers to the show kind of decide the direction of the show. We're never quite sure what people are going to want to talk about and really what sparks passion and imagination. But if you're one of the first callers, you may direct the whole show. So that canal service provider, as we heard at the top of the news on NPR, that canal service provider says that workers in Suez, Egypt, have successfully set free a colossal ship container that for nearly a week has been stuck sideways across the Suez Canal, one of the world's most crucial arteries for trade. The Leth agency says the vessel was refloated this morning. Helped by the peak of high tide, a flotilla of tugboats managed to wrench the bow of the skyscraper-sized ship, the Ever Given, from the sandy back of the crucial waterway where it had been firmly lodged since last Tuesday. A joint World Health Organization China study on the origins of COVID-19 says that transmission from bats to humans through another animal is the most likely scenario, and that a lab leak of the coronavirus was extremely unlikely. A draft copy was obtained today by the Associated Press. The findings offered little new insight into how the virus first emerged and leave many questions unanswered, though that was as expected. But the report does provide more detail on the reasoning behind the researchers' conclusions. The report's release has been repeatedly delayed, raising questions about whether the Chinese side was trying to skew the conclusions. The AP received a copy from a Geneva-based diplomat from a WHO member country. And then a former Minneapolis police officer is now on trial in Minneapolis in George Floyd's death. And jurors may not wait long to see parts of the bystander video that caught Derek Chauvin's knee on George Floyd's neck. Prosecutors have not said when they will play the video, but legal experts say they expect it to be early in the trial as part of an effort to remind jurors of what is at stake. The widely seen video sparked waves of outrage and activism across the U.S. and beyond, and while it will have an impact, the key questions at trial are likely to be whether Chauvin caused Floyd's death and whether his actions were reasonable. Florida's so-called anti-riot bill is now moving to the state Senate in Tallahassee after winning approval from the House last week. The measure's momentum could slow down considerably as the lawmakers approach the midway point of their two-month session, with a number of weeks left before the legislature's scheduled adjournment at the end of April. Lawmakers are also beginning to tackle the state budget with more urgency. Both the Senate and the House unveiled their spending plans in recent days, and budget writers from both chambers must now reconcile their versions with the governor's budget version that he put out a few weeks ago. 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to the first caller. Let's go to Lee. And Lee, thanks for calling. Where are you?
Oh, I'm in Spring Hill, but the Florida legislature is just trying to bring back Jim Crow laws with their new voter suppression.
They are trying to limit mail-in voting, no doubt about it. You think that's just like repressing black people in the 1800s and early 1900s?
Yeah, it ain't too far gone. And as far as Trump like DeSantis, as far as us having a demonstration, he's going to decide whether you're rioting and a threat.
Yeah. So, have you mentioned this to your state legislators? Have you said that you think this is a bad idea?
Well, look, I'm up here in Hernando County. My congressman is Daniel Webster. How far do you think I'm going to get on that?
Well, is Blazing Golia your state representative? I forget whether Blaze is.
And then the other two are Senator No Show Marco and Skeletor Scott. You think I'm going to get any traction there?
Well, but the anti-riot bill, the so-called anti-riot bill, is being debated in Tallahassee. So you want to, if you want to have input, you want to talk to your state representative and state senator.
Okay, well, I'm not up on my state representatives. I've found them mostly useless. But thank you for taking my call, and you guys have a good day.
All right, Lee, thank you. Thank you. Well, could that be part of the problem, that we don't know our state senators and our state representatives, and we don't have a relationship with them? We had a state senator on last week who said that she had heard from constituents who said that they feared the protesters who walked in the streets. And so that's why she's going to vote for the anti-riot bill. But if Lee from up there in Spring Hill isn't calling his state representatives because he feels like it's not going to count or they're not going to listen, then maybe our state representatives and legislators are only hearing from one side. Let's go to Nancy in St. Petersburg. Hey, Nancy, you're on MNF. Thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Hi. I'm still rattled about Georgia's latest move with voter suppression, and So I was thinking, how can you get if people prevail in a election, and then what they voted for is completely ignored, like here in Florida and in Missouri and in Georgia, you know, how is it possible to enforce these things, enforce what the voters have done? And so I Googled everything I could think of, and they all come point to one thing, and that's the legislature. Well, if everything legislature, why isn't anything, even if it's put into voters' hands like a referendum, well, look what's happened in Florida. So then I thought, well, there's got to be something. So then I remembered a book I read in 2017, before all of this has happened, and it was Nancy McLean's Democracy in Chains. And by golly, this thing has been going on, this kind of thing, since the Constitution was signed by a gentleman named John C. Calhoun. Who was a vice president and a senator way back then. And then in 1956, Buchanan found, his name and started it up. And we've been on this ride ever since. And it's because people who collect, they don't want people who can get together and collectively make demands of their representatives and have those things come to fruition. They don't want that to happen. And this is where we are today, and that's why everything doesn't work.
Well, maybe. But Nancy, I was struck by Lee's call earlier where he says he doesn't know who his state senators and state representatives are. So,
well, that's incumbent on everybody to find that out.
So if Lee's not communicating with issues that he cares about with his state legislators, then, he might be just he might just be one in a million. There may be millions of people like Lee that just feel like, well, I don't really want to call my state legislator's office and leave word that I'm against HB1 because I don't trust them, or they're up in Tallahassee. They won't listen to me.
It all goes to race. It all stems from that. It all stems from when the Constitution was written and how it was written, by whom it was written, and not that there's something inherently wrong with the Constitution, except that they didn't want to have people of other people's voice heard, except those of the planter class. There was the idea that there are those who ride and those who are the donkeys to be ridden, and the whole thing is, says we have not come anywhere since then, except we've held on. Every once in a while, somebody will come through, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt or LBJ, who really had no choice but to do this for civil rights. And anybody, but it has been a battle for things that should have been, on the face of it, of fairness and equality. And we're still battling that same thing. And you can't find anything that, right now, it's going to be like the Obama years, where this is a complete obstruction all the way down the line. And now they're talking about diluting the filibuster. You should just get rid of the damn filibuster. And that's all I want to say about
that. All right. Nancy, thanks a lot. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
All right. Good to hear from you. And you're listening to 88.5 FM. Let's go to Nav in Tampa. Nav, what would you like to comment about?
Hello, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I want to discuss the COVID and the origins of the virus. And, you know, these SAR viruses traditionally only attack the respiratory system. This particular virus, now we learned in the last 1 year, in addition to attacking the respiratory system, it attacks the digestive system, the heart, the brain. It causes neurological problems. It attacks the blood, causing micro blood clots, large blood clots. The point I'm trying to get at is this virus is very different from its cousin, these other viruses that just only attack the respiratory system. Why is it not possible, and I'm not saying it happened, but why is people like dismissing, oh, it didn't come from a lab? It could be that this virus was altered to attack all organs of the body to cause blood clots, and it was inadvertently, I don't think it was deliberate, leaked from that Wuhan lab. The Chinese military, the American military, the Russian military, we all know over the years they've been playing around with viruses and bacteria to see what's doable, not doable. And what I find odd is the media and the general public, anyone who brings Wuhan lab into play is, oh, conspiracy theory, not possible. But why can't it be possible? I think we can't rule it out.
Well, Navin, it's always good to ask a question, but I think that the science is pretty well established that this virus is related to other viruses that have been found in animals that cause similar symptoms. I mean, I think, you know, the latest WHO China study on the origins of COVID-19 say the transmission came from bats to humans, though another animal is most likely, might have been involved as well. I mean, fine to raise the question, but I think that there are scientists out there that are looking at this, and it's not like there's an international cabal. We're not living in a James Bond film, for instance, where there's this international evil organization. Scientists are looking at it, and they're publishing papers, and they're being debated in the science community. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just supposed to say, even the WHO China report that was just issued the last today or yesterday, they even used very passive language. They said it's most likely from a bat and most unlikely from a lab, but they didn't say definitively. So
no, that's true, but that's the way science operates. I mean, they're slow to reach a definitive conclusion, and they publish their results, and then other scientists look at it and say, no, you got this wrong and that wrong. I mean, that's the way the scientific method is. So I think it's perfectly fine that you ask that question, but there's some people that no matter what the WHO says, they're not going to believe it, and that's what I'm arguing against. I think there are fair scientists out there that are looking at this, and let's see where the science goes.
Right. Well, and in fairness, I don't think right now neither party can claim to know exactly whether it was from, because these bats have these viruses all the time. How do we go from bat to human, and then one of the most infectious disease ever known to humanity, where it spread like wildfire? That just seems odd to me.
I think it's fair you ask the question. I just don't buy into the conspiracy theorists that want to blame the Chinese lab for letting it loose. I mean, if they knew how bad it was, they let's hope that they wouldn't leave it loose on their own people.
I think it was accidental. I don't think they deliberately released it. Yeah. But I'm just saying that the Chinese military, our military, we all do this. Like, it's not.
Yeah, no, it's a problem. I think the militaries in all of our countries do too much research on evil stuff. So, Nav, thanks a lot. Thank you, Nav. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
There's a great movie, if you haven't seen it, it's a Steven Soderbergh movie called Contagion, and it came out before the COVID crisis. But the very last scene, I'll spill the beans, and I'll give a spoiler alert. If you don't want to know how the movie ends, then don't listen to the next 15 seconds. But basically, the movie ends showing that this disease, which is very much like COVID, I mean, Soderbergh predicted COVID, something like COVID would happen. The very end scene of the movie shows that a bat bites a pig that's about to go to the slaughterhouse. The pig is slaughtered, and then the food of the pig, the ham or whatever, is fed to some tourists in Hong Kong, including an American. And that's the way the virus outbreaks. So it goes from bat. Now, this is the way that Soderbergh, a fictional movie, described it. But that may be what happened. We don't know. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Sharon in St. Petersburg. Sharon, thanks for calling. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Rob. I'm really concerned about the state of our democracy. What I find very troubling is the fact that we can get many Americans, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, to approve of a bill and it won't pass through the Senate. It's very disturbing to me in that it has become an oligarchy, and the only people who are really represented to certain senators are their donors. And I think that's been a little overlooked.
Yeah, I think the role of money in politics is really important, and it keeps some senators secure, even though they may have a state that is more 50-50, but if they have large donors on their side, they can often win an election. Yeah, the state of democracy is precarious in the U.S., no doubt about it.
Yeah, and it's also gerrymandering.
Well, gerrymandering when it comes
Mitch
to state
McConnell
legislatures
really
and congressional seats.
To
yep.
pick the federal judges that he did. And they will continue to gerrymander our country and break up. And they'll be divisive about how they do it and continue to pit us against them instead of, you know, uniting us.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. Sharon, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thanks.
I think the question is, well, how do we make the country more small-d democratic? How do we make sure that everybody who's a citizen has the right to vote and that's not infringed on? How do we make sure that districts are drawn fairly and not drawn just simply to elect one party over the other? And how do we keep big money out of politics? I think those are all really good questions. Jeff writes this, can liberals and conservatives agree that freedom of speech must be protected? Can liberals and conservatives agree that violence cannot be tolerated? It seems like this riot bill is trying to lump all of this together, writes Jeff. Yeah, we already have laws on the books against violence and crime, but now they're trying to add to it. And I think Tara made a good point. Let's say that you're out your team wins a national championship and you head for the streets and you start smashing car windows because you're so ecstatic and you've got all this energy built up by the national win. Well, let's say the person down the street, though, doesn't smash the car window and doesn't doesn't light something on fire, you know, and you know how crazy people can get after winning a championship sometimes. Well, then, does everybody get charged with the crime of bashing the car window or lighting something on fire? That seems to be, in effect, what this anti-riot bill would do. You may have been in demonstrations. Maybe you've been in a demonstration anti-war, or maybe you've been in a demonstration anti-abortion, or maybe you've been in an anti-mask demonstration, or maybe you've been in a demonstration against police brutality. And somebody in that group, maybe of 500 people or 1,000, does something wrong. They break a law. They commit a felony. Well, should everybody in that group then be charged with committing a felony? That's what this anti-riot bill would do. Bev writes, Wednesday's guest on Talking Animals will be local photographer Carlton Ward Jr., who's devoted 5 years to producing extraordinary and rare pictures of the Florida panther. Yeah, Carlton's been a guest on this show a lot. He's one of the great local photographers, and he's going to talk about what it took to capture the Florida panther on film on Duncan's show at 10 o'clock this coming Wednesday. Fran writes this, I'm curious, due to the complexity of COVID and statistics on reinfections, vaccine effectiveness, herd immunity, etc., is there a place or a website that lists the least contested statistics. In other words, where do we have the most consensus? Johns Hopkins University has a really good website. There are great websites out there that are just filled with objective data. And Fran, I would start with the Johns Hopkins website, and there's others too. And when I get off the air, if you want to email me at rob@wmnf.org, I'll suggest a few more. Let's go back to the phones, and we're going to go to Chris in Sarasota. Hey, Chris, you're on MNF. What's up?
Hey, thank you, Rob. An ex-Trump in the paper today, lawyer, so Trump is kind of helping this out, but she's spearheading all of the Republican fight for, you know, voter suppression is what I call it.
And where is this lawyer based? What's her name?
Sita Mitchell.
And where is she based?
It doesn't say where she's at. But she was helping him out through the, you know, the election fraud stuff, trying out all kind of things. So she's in it, and, you know, no doubt in cahoots with Trump, too, him telling him what to do, what he'd like to see.
Okay, well, I'll have to look her up. I'm not familiar with her. Maybe I should be, but it doesn't. Yeah. But, Chris, thanks a lot.
And the George Floyd video happened within about first 15 minutes of the trial.
Oh, they already played it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Chris, thanks a lot. Thanks for that update.
Thank you.
All right. Great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Let's go to John in Port Richey. Hey, John, you're on MNF.
Hey, thanks for the show, Rob. I'm just trying to understand the logic of one of the callers there that called back and said that this virus could have come from a lab in China. I mean, I just don't get the logic there that they believe this theory that it could come from this lab in China without any evidence to back it up, but yet they don't believe the idea that it could have come from bats, even though there's evidence to back that up. I mean, I don't think there's going to be anything that will be definitive to say it came from A or B. So you got to kind of look at the evidence and weigh it and go, well, there's more weight behind this idea versus it could be this idea. And that just boggles my brain that seems to be a very consistent thought process that I've seen in the conservative mindset. It's always, this could be true without any evidence to really back those statements up, where you can argue all the facts in the world on that this other thing could be true. They won't believe it. I don't know if it's just that they can't accept that it could be something different than their mindset. I just don't understand that logic, Rob.
Well, John, it's not new. I mean, you're probably old enough to remember the debate over tobacco. I mean, we had a long ongoing debate even after the 1964 report on the dangers of tobacco, even after the Surgeon Generals came out.
Go back and look at the Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson. He has a great episode on that, but he goes back to the lead argument. And he shows how the lead argument that people were saying, you know, keeping lead in gas was wrong and it was doing this, and they finally did it. And he shows how the tobacco industry used the exact same process that the lead industry used back in the 50s or something.
Yeah, it's a technique that's used. Yeah, you're right, John. It's a technique that's used over and over again. And it's not based on science. It's just based on asking the question. Like I said to the guy, I think it's okay to ask the question, but there is science that has moved forward and is getting closer to the answer. So let's also pay attention to that. Don't just ask the wild question, which is okay, but also find out that there are scientists working on the issue, and don't ignore them. Anonymous writes in, is it okay to restrict voting but not okay to restrict gun ownership? If you feel like there's a big problem in the U.S., do you think it's the problem of people voting, or do you think it's the problem of too many unqualified people having guns? What do you think? And which one are our politicians addressing? Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments about this show tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sean Canan. He's coming up next. He's going to talk about the crisis along the U.S. border, the influx of refugees coming to our border, And thanks to Frank Knox, our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lori. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota. Here's the latest news.